Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 11th of April, these are our main stories. More than 50 are dead after an airstrike on an opposition-controlled village in Myanmar. The UN's appalling choice over continuing to work in Afghanistan. And Australia braces for its largest cyclone in over a decade. Also in this podcast...
There were a few people saying you can't make jokes about the Troubles because for a long period of time there was nothing on radio or TV and all the theatres had been blown up.
Finding comedy in the most unlikely circumstances. We begin this podcast in Myanmar, where more than 50 people are reported dead after an airstrike in an area where there's been resistance to the military government. Survivors say the armed forces dropped a bomb on a village in the region of Sagaing before firing on those below from a helicopter. Conflict between the government and ethnic armed groups has been ever more fierce since the military coup of 2021. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head told us more.
Well, we've seen the video that villagers have uploaded. One of my colleagues has spoken to someone there, although communications are exceptionally difficult in Myanmar. It's pretty clear this was another airstrike. I say another one because the military government has been relying increasingly on air power because its own troops find it so difficult to move around in areas where opposition is very strong. And this is one of them. This is southern Sagaing, where some of the strongest armed opposition to the military has developed, where there are an awful lot of volunteer militias and communities who are running themselves. And this particular village, they were opening their own administration office today in defiance of military authority. I mean, it's quite likely that's a reason it was targeted. It's possible also the military thought there were strong opposition military forces there. Either way, the locals tell us that a jet came in at about 7 a.m. and dropped a bomb on the village. And then a helicopter gunship, these very powerful Russian helicopter gunships the Myanmar military has, came in and strafed the village with its cannon for about 20 minutes. It's left dreadful scenes of carnage. I mean, the video is almost unwatchable. They reckon that they've counted at least 53 bodies, 15 of them women and quite a number of them children.
So the villagers have uploaded this shocking video. Any comment at all by the Myanmar military?
Not yet. It's early in the day. I don't think anyone's managed to get anything out of them. They may well respond. They respond often to the worst, the strongest allegations of atrocities by their forces. And routinely they tend to say, oh, someone else. But obviously in this case, because it's an airstrike, it really can't be anyone else. So I suspect they may use the same justification they used for an equally horrific airstrike on a school last September when something like 13 people were killed, including 7 children in their class. And they claimed, well, it was being used to store weapons, although they never produced any evidence of that after they sort of took over the village. So I would expect that kind of explanation. We've never had any admission of excesses so far by the Burmese military.
And just finally, we obviously talked a great deal about the military coup in February 2021 and its immediate aftermath. Just explain to us the security situation since then.
Well, it's still really bad. It's in some places, like Sagaing, it's diabolical. The consequences for the people living there have been absolutely catastrophic. Huge numbers of villages have been burnt. Thousands of homes have been burnt. These people have nothing. They don't even have the materials to rebuild. They have no access to international help. A lot of the farming has been disrupted. There is severe humanitarian needs. We've got 1.5 million people displaced inside Myanmar. But you've also got a situation where the military had wanted to limit its emergency rule to 2 years. It's now gone beyond that. No, but it's completely unconstitutional. It had hoped to hold an election this year, excluding Aung San Suu Kyi and the National League for Democracy. That isn't happening. It's desperate to restore control, and it's increasingly relying on this really indiscriminate air power with consequent and really terrible civilian casualties.
Jonathan Head. The United Nations says it's being forced to make an appalling choice in Afghanistan after the country's Taliban government banned women from working for the organisation there. The UN is trying to balance helping those in desperate need and standing by women's rights. The mission's head, Rosa Otunbayeva, has now launched an operational review and told staff not to go to their offices until the 5th of May. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, explained why the UN is speaking out now.
Well, now, because what they have feared for many months has become public and official insofar as anything from the Taliban has become official. United Nations officials told me privately in December that they had heard murmurings, they'd even seen documents being drawn up, that they too, like the non-governmental organizations, would soon be handed an order that women could no longer work as part of their humanitarian operations. I was in Afghanistan in January, where that order never came to the UN, when very senior United Nations officials came to Afghanistan to try to convince the Taliban to overturn the edict affecting non-governmental agencies. So they've been thinking about this for a long time, dreading it. And now that it is in the open, they are caught in, to use their expression, an impossible position. There's the humanitarian principle of providing food and aid to people, whatever the political situation. But there's also the principle of the United Nations about women's rights and independent aid and providing for everyone. It is an absolutely appalling choice.
And you know Afghanistan so well, you have traveled there extensively. Just remind us, how much help do people in Afghanistan need right now, and what happens if the UN can't provide it?
Afghanistan has the terrible distinction of being described by many aid agencies, including the United Nations, as not only the worst humanitarian situation in the world, but also the one where it is the most difficult to provide aid to those who desperately need it. The Taliban keep throwing up these obstacles in the way of the United Nations work. And don't forget, this is a government where so many of the senior Taliban are still under sanctions, list to terrorism offenses. And so it is only the United Nations and the non-governmental agencies who are getting the money needed to be able to provide aid for people. If the United Nations stops distributing, on top of the programs that have been suspended by the non-governmental agencies, then literally there will be no one to turn to.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. One of the victims was tortured and then fell to his death from a fifth-floor window. Another was simply shot while he sat on a park bench. What these and several other killings have in common was that they were all associated with the Italian mafia, and specifically with a power struggle currently underway in the capital, Rome, between rival gangsters. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, reports.
This is in some ways a classic problem. What you've had is that quite a lot of senior mafia people have actually been arrested recently. I mean, the most famous was Matteo Messina Denaro, who was a big, big figure who'd been on the run for several decades, arrested in January. Most people think, well, that's good news. The trouble is that then leaves a vacuum, which prompts other gangs and gangsters to fight over who fills it. It's like sort of playing a very bizarre game of whack-a-mole, where every time you whack one mole, the others all start killing each other. Now, the mafia is normally associated with the south of Italy, with the Cosa Nostra in Sicily, the Camorra in Naples. But this, as you said, is a battle about Rome, specifically who controls the cocaine trade. Now, Rome does have its own homegrown mafia, the Banda della Magliana, but other mafia groups from around Italy seem to be muscling in. And what we're talking about here is not big mafia figures being killed. It seems to be low-level street dealers who've got caught up in the violence. I mean, one poor neighbourhood of Rome, Torpignatra, had three killings in a week. It's hard to say who's killing who. You've got regional gangs against each other, fighting within the regions. The only thing that's certain is people are dying.
That was Paul Moss. Over recent years, Australia has been beset with floods, wildfires and scorching temperatures. Now the authorities there are preparing for a once-in-a-decade storm, which is due to slam into the country's west coast. A tropical cyclone warning has been issued. Jessica Lingard of the Bureau of Meteorology in Western Australia spoke to my colleague Andrew Peach.
At the moment, we have a tropical low. It's located about 400 kilometres north of a large township called Broome in the northwest of WA. We are expecting that to strengthen into a tropical cyclone through the rest of this afternoon. At that stage, it will be called Tropical Cyclone Ilsa. It is going to continue moving to the southwest over the next couple of days, continuing to strengthen as it does so into a Category 4 system, which is a severe tropical cyclone. It'll then take a bit of a turn towards the southeast and head towards the coastline, crossing the coast on Thursday evening local time as a Category 4 system before it moves inland and starts to weaken.
What sort of impact is it supposed to have once it gets to Broome, once it hits the coast?
Well, it'll actually cross the coast just to the south of Broome, which is a good thing, really. It sort of heads through a mostly unpopulated area, but with a Category 4 system, we could see wind gusts up to 280 kilometres an hour. That's 174 miles per hour. We could see heavy rainfall, even as much as 350 millimetres, which could cause widespread flooding through the area and cause roads to be closed for at least 48 hours, if not longer. This is a very strong system, so we could see roofing loss. We could see significant structural damage. We could even see, you know, things like caravans, trailers, boats, that sort of thing becoming airborne and, you know, becoming a bit of a dangerous projectile.
That was Jessica Lingard in Western Australia. President Biden is due to arrive in Northern Ireland later on Tuesday for a visit to mark 25 years since the Good Friday Agreement. Mr. Biden said he was looking forward to the anniversary in Belfast and said the US was committed to preserving peace and encouraging prosperity. Our North America editor Sarah Smith reports.
President Biden is extremely proud of his Irish roots. He mentions them frequently. He also feels a deep personal connection to the Good Friday Agreement, as one of the senior US politicians who advocated for America's crucial involvement in the negotiations which brought an end to 3 decades of violent conflict. The president will be greeted personally by Rishi Sunak when he arrives in Belfast this evening. Tomorrow he will visit Ulster University's newly opened Belfast campus, where he will emphasise his country's willingness to support the economic potential of Northern Ireland.
When the Good Friday Agreement was signed back in 1998, comedy about the violence during the Troubles was almost unheard of. But a TV sitcom called Give My Head Peace hit the screens not long after the agreement and broke many taboos. Tim McGarry, who wrote and starred in the comedy, has been speaking to my colleague Martha Carney.
How risky did it seem back in the day when you first came up with the idea of Give My Head Peace?
Quite risky, to be honest with you, because at the time we started doing comedy in theatres, the Troubles were still on. It was still quite nasty. And there were a few people saying, you can't make jokes about the Troubles, because for a long period of time, there was nothing on radio or TV and all the theatres had been blown up. So there was no live comedy or proper comedy satirising the situation in Northern Ireland. So when we first started, we were actually quite scared. But what we tapped into was a kind of war weariness. There was this sense that sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, this situation was never going to change. Everybody was fed up about it. But finally, there were people talking about what everybody else was talking about, but doing it in a comedy way and satirizing the politicians and having a go at the paramilitaries and, you know, tapped into a huge sense of relief for people.
PSNI torturing me with their ridiculous questions. What did you do in 1987? How am I supposed to know that, sir? Can't even remember what organisation it was in.
But having a go at the paramilitaries, even as I say it, that does sound like you're taking a bit of a risk.
Yeah, it was, but we quickly gained a reputation for being even-handed. So we did have a go at the paramilitaries, and we did have a go at the British government, and we did have a go at the politicians, and we did have a go at everybody, but there was nobody really having a proper go at the paramilitary, saying, clearly saying and satirising them and saying what they were doing was wrong and immoral, but also doing it in a way that was accessible to people by being funny. And if you're laughing, it's very hard to be bitter. You know, it's very hard to get angry if you're laughing at the same time.
I have a circular here from Martin McGuinness. He says that now that he is back as Minister for Education, would people please stop making those old jokes about him?
Jokes like a minister's 3 R's, reading, writing and armalites.
Jokes like that. Clearly the comedy you were doing felt very edgy at the time. What do you think has changed and why?
Well, what has changed is that the threat of violence has gone. But I'm afraid the fundamental division in this society still remains. You know, we're still a very segregated society. Our schools are segregated. The housing is segregated. Our two main political parties are basically religious blocs. One of the criticisms of the Good Friday Agreement is that it kind of copper-fastened sectarianism and nailed it into the political system. Those issues are still there and they're still very live. So comedians a lot younger than me from Northern Ireland are still making jokes about Catholics and Protestants and the differences between us. And it's one of those things that just won't go away and won't go away for the foreseeable future.
Tim McGarry was speaking to Martha Carney. Still to come.
There's this amazing calm before the storm, like all the air is basically sucked out of the atmosphere and you're just sitting there waiting. It's nerve-wracking.
The perils of rowing across the Pacific Ocean.
The Comb is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out stories and voices from across Africa that might otherwise go unheard.
It was a moment that was filled with hope.
It was emotional.
I had to sit down and put myself in other people's shoes.
Catch up with the whole series now by searching for The Comb.
This is The Comb.
The Comb.
The Comb.
Wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Comb.
In a show of strength, the United States and Philippines have launched their largest ever joint military drills. The Balikatan operation will last a fortnight and involve more than 17,000 troops. Chinese forces performed their own large-scale military drills off the coast of Taiwan over the past week. The chief of staff of the Armed Forces of the Philippines, General Andres Centeno, said Manila and Washington work well together in the region.
As the collaboration and partnerships grow in strength and reach, we not only amplify and upgrade the interoperability of our armed forces for mutual defense, humanitarian assistance and disaster response, but just as importantly, contribute to the peace and stability of the Indo-Pacific region in a definitive manner.
Our correspondent Shaima Khalil told us more about the exercises.
These exercises have been pre-planned, and they've been pre-planned when the U.S. secured a new defense deal with the Philippines earlier this year. We now know that four new naval bases will be established in the Philippine Islands. Last month, they both came out to say that this Balikatan, which actually means shoulder to shoulder in Tagalog, is going to be their largest ever. It's going to involve more than 17,000 troops, 12,000 American and about 5,400 Philippine troops. It is going to include, for example, a live fire exercise on a sunken ship in the South China Sea. The Philippines has been at pains, really, from military officials to the spokesman for the Philippines Army to the president himself, President Marcos Jr. himself, have been at pains to say that this collaboration with Washington, this military cooperation with Washington is not an aggressive move. This is to bolster the Philippines' military powers and military abilities.
Now I mentioned that Chinese forces have had their own large-scale military drills off Taiwan over the past week. Taiwan actually says that eight Chinese warships are still there. Is there a lot of tension in the region? How would you characterize what's going on?
Oh, I think there's an extremely heightened tension in the region. And it's very interesting, Jackie, because I think for a very, very long time, we often talk about tension between the United States and China, this heightening of the rhetoric, ratcheting up of the rhetoric. And I think the translation of it, the on the ground, in the waters, in the air translation of it has been happening in the last few days. You've got this military drills between the U.S. and the Philippines taking place just a day after China concluded its own military drills, Operation Joint Sword, in response to the Taiwanese president's visit to the United States. For 3 days, from Saturday to Monday, China has essentially simulated sealing off Taiwan. We've seen aircraft. We've heard from the Taiwanese Defense Ministry that more than 30 aircraft have crossed into their air defense space. There was a Chinese aircraft carrier in the water. So those two military exercises happening right after one another is a translation of the U.S. and China trying to assert their powers, their military powers in the region.
Shaima Khalil. The Ukrainian authorities say 174 square kilometres have been contaminated by landmines since Russia's full-scale invasion in February last year. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse sent this report from the Kharkiv region, where most have been found.
It's hard to describe this scene as anything other than random. We are on the main road going through the small town of Balaklia. To my right, there is a closed cafe kiosk surrounded by some shrubbery, really. But at the moment, there are mine danger signs hammered into the earth, and a team from the emergency services are sweeping their metal detectors across the immediate area. They're looking for so-called butterfly mines. Alexander Romanets is in charge of this search and is all too aware of the occupational hazards.
My family calls me in the morning and tells me to be careful, to watch where I tread. Of course, they are worried. Before, we would work with shells from World War II, and now there are modern munitions, so we have to learn constantly, because we find new kinds that we haven't encountered before.
Butterfly mines are banned under international law because of how they are used indiscriminately. They don't look like much either, around 3 to 4 inches wide. They're green. We can see one just dug up to the side here further away. But the damage they can cause is severe. Inside Azum's damaged hospital, in a small, stuffy room, is Serhii. The 56-year-old is one of two patients who are missing a foot from stepping on a mine. A few weeks ago, he brushed against an apricot tree as he helped a friend load his car.
I used to be healthy, walk with both of my feet, do things, drive my car, and then in an instant, I had no home and no food. A homeless person without a foot, in a second. Before the war, I used to have greenhouses, two cows, would sell milk and grew cucumbers and tomatoes for sale. Now I only have disability pension. It's such a shame.
Ukraine says 724 people have been blown up by Russian explosives since February last year. 226 of them died. And, in Izyum, there is an appetite to better understand this resident threat. In the fire station, the Red Cross gives lectures to a packed room on how to look out for mines. Irina is one of them.
I am very cautious. I don't walk around much, but when I do, I use the same pass because I'm scared. I have a 16-year-old son and I'm really worried about him going out on his own. I tell him about the mines. I wish he was here to listen to this.
Back in Balaklia, the butterfly mine search is reaching its conclusion. So we're now having to back off from the search site. They've moved the collected mines across the road into a courtyard, and they're going to blow them up with a 1 kilo explosive. Whenever this war finally ends, it is likely to be decades before towns like Izyum and Balaklia will be considered safe. That means more deaths and injuries long after the guns fall quiet.
That was James Waterhouse in Kharkiv, Ukraine. Artificial intelligence tool ChatGPT has taken the tech world by storm. The chatbot has developed at such a rapid rate that even the likes of Elon Musk and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak signed an open letter calling for a pause on AI development based on the challenges it poses to humanity. One of these challenges is to education, and ChatGPT's ability to write fresh and original essays for school kids and university students so they don't have to. So how will academia be forced to adjust? A question for Professor Rose Luckin of University College London, co-founder of the Institute for Ethical AI in Education, and Professor Bhaskar Veera, pro-vice-chancellor for education at the University of Cambridge.
You'd hope that a medical doctor would have a basic knowledge of the human anatomy before we let them loose on patients. So a certain amount of content which is knowledge-based will continue to be important in certain types of teaching. But in terms of other forms of teaching, just treating students as empty vessels that we have to fill up with knowledge, I think is no longer going to be sort of the default mode. The knowledge-based curriculum has to be replaced and supplemented with other forms of intelligence, you know, the human forms of intelligence. The ability to make connections between previously unrelated forms of literature, to connect ideas that have previously not been connected, the sort of higher level thinking that maybe a machine isn't necessarily going to be very good at.
Professor Luckin, does this moment mean we have to seriously rethink the school curriculum, that the children of today will grow up in a world where even more jobs will be affected by AI?
Thank you, Michelle. Yes, absolutely. I think it does. I think it's a pivotal moment. I think if we look across the world, the countries that are going to lead the way are the ones that are focused on ensuring that their populations have three core abilities. AI literacy, so that they can work alongside and with AI. High-level thinking skills, things like problem-solving, self-regulation, collaboration. And thirdly, knowledge about knowledge, understanding how to tell truth from fiction, understanding what knowledge is, where it comes from, what good evidence is, and knowledgeable about the world rather than being well-informed, and knowledgeable about themselves, which is a key thing, because being knowledgeable about ourselves is a way of differentiating ourselves from our AI peers. And that's extremely important.
So if we think about the frontiers of knowledge pushing the boundaries of what we know, aren't there examples, Professor Vera, of AI doing exactly that? There was a study by researchers in Britain and Germany the other day that said it could even now work out better than most humans the most unconventional uses of a fork. Now, I know that might be a pretty niche thing, but it just shows, to use that term, it can think outside the box.
I think that's probably true, but at the same time, it's also been reported to be associated with what people call hallucination. It makes things up. So these are language models. These predict words which might plausibly follow each other. They don't necessarily bear resemblance to reality. So I know of examples where citations have been fictionalized, plausible authors who might plausibly have written an article, but actually you find that the AI has actually just generated an article that doesn't exist. You ask it to do a plot summary. Sometimes it makes up characters that don't exist in the book.
Okay. So I just want to ask you a quick final thought about assessment, because you mentioned it earlier. Does it mean the end of open book exams or coursework?
Not necessarily. So we've been thinking about this quite a lot. And I think you mentioned in the introduction that, you know, we're working together across the Russell Group universities, but a number of others. And while it does make it easier for people to submit work which has been generated through AI, I think we have to go back to the expectation that students submit for assessment work that is their own original work. So this is no different to the rules that we have against things like plagiarism, the rules that we have against collusion. The use of AI would be seen as violating those basic principles that you're not submitting your own original work.
Professor Bhaskar Vera and Professor Rose Luckin were speaking to Michelle Hussein. Now, earlier we heard about a cyclone approaching Australia, but what about someone who has faced them alone out at sea and prevailed? 50-year-old Australian Michelle Lee overcame 5 hurricanes, 4 cyclones and a shark that jumped into her boat to become the first woman to row solo across the Pacific Ocean unassisted and without stopping. We heard from Michelle about how she survived the elements.
There's this amazing calm before the storm, like literally a calm before the storm, where all the air is basically sucked out of the atmosphere and you're just sitting there waiting. It's nerve-wracking, you know. So there was 5 hurricanes coming down the coast of Mexico in the North Pacific, and then we had 4 in the South Pacific.
That's just incredible. And at various points you had to just sort of stay in your cabin, didn't you?
Yeah, so certain strategies that we take when we are facing storms, and one of them is to put out a sea anchor, which basically just stabilizes your boat and holds your bow into the conditions. During those moments, you are locked up in a cabin, which my first stint was a 9-day lockup in my tiny cabin, which is basically like sitting underneath your dining room table. And it's hot, it's sweaty, it's sticky, and sometimes you've got the sun shining in through your hat. And, you know, you still have to go out there for your number ones and twos. You still got to get out on deck at some point to go and deal with life. So, yeah, no, it was certainly a challenging experience.
Well, we won't go into the details of your comfort breaks, but what did you do to pass the time?
During the 9 days, I tell you what, I got to know myself very well. I got to know the inside of my cabin very intimately. And thank God I had a 24-hour, 7-day unlimited sat phone. So I think anyone who was in my contact list got a call from me during those moments.
What did you learn about yourself during this journey?
to realise that this too shall pass. I know, you know, it sounds like a cheap saying, but it's true. So whenever there was weather patterns that were not favourable and things weren't quite going my way, I just had to remind myself that this doesn't last forever. You know, often I had an attitude readjustment where I would turn it into, you know, what can I be grateful for? What are the things that are working well on my boat? Who can I be appreciative of? Gratitude and appreciation were my go-to.
Michelle Lee. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Mozechka. The producer was Alfie Habershon. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
One of the most dangerous and prolific criminal hacking gangs in the world.
They're accused of robbing banks, stealing secrets, and causing mayhem everywhere, from hospitals to Hollywood.
Investigators say they're working on the orders of the North Korean state.
A claim dismissed by the regime as an attempt to tarnish the country's image.
A sovereign nation trying to earn revenue to fund weapons of mass destruction.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
In season 2 of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service,
we're picking up from where season 1 left off.
Far from disappearing into the shadows, it seems the Lazarus Group has been busy.
We have tracked your funds to a North Korean account.
Carrying out ever more elaborate money grabs.
Coordinating in more than 20 countries.
And they're not working alone.
He organized money laundering operations.
They found over $100,000 cash under his mattress.
Search for The Lazarus Heist wherever you get your BBC podcasts.